February 1st, about an hour's drive east of Inverness, where our friends in the south insist on referring to it as the north of Scotland, when in fact it's only halfway up. And you've probably guessed by now that I'm not a Scot. After nearly 20 years living in France, we chose to come and live here in Scotland. And I should add that perhaps I'm here under false pretenses, because I'm pretty sure I've never been a theist. So can I legitimately be a non-theist? Perhaps I am. We hoped, when we were having the idea of these talks, that we would all be encouraged to take a new look down the Quaker kaleidoscope, perhaps see something new, something different. I'm sure my next few words will not be consistent, but I hope they will be coherent. And you may conclude that I've not so much shaken up the kaleidoscope as broken it, then jumped up and down upon the pieces in either rage, frustration, glee, or both. The power of the silence of our worship is perhaps our engine room, the energy source which gives us fuel to fire up the tenacity we must have to fulfill our determination to establish the commune of heaven upon earth. Not kingdom. If silence is our engine room, then the words we use are our drive shafts and our propellers to move us along. Our ambitions are driven by our words. Words present our actions and our determination to act to the rest of the world. And for us Quakers, that holds true for any time since the mid-17th century. And it's words that fascinate me, and words which I want to talk about. But the problem is that other organisations also use words, often the same ones. Words which contradict the ones we use and are shouted much more loudly from many more rooftops than we have ever managed to access. It's some of those words and phrases I'd like to look at. And I'll begin by offering a definition from the Shorter Oxford. Religion, an action or conduct indicating a belief in, reverence for, and a desire to please a divine ruling power. Recognition on the part of man of some higher unseen power as having control of his destiny, and as being entitled to obedience, reverence, and worship. The general moral and mental attitude resulting from this belief. But surely religion need not have anything to do with religion. Although when we hear that word, we immediately think of cathedrals and churches and chapels and synagogues and mosques and all the rest. For some, it can mean a football team, a political party. And for many millions of people in the world, it means compulsory or else obedience to a creed which rests upon fear. Please, if you can, bear that in mind for the next few minutes, and the power and authority which a divinely appointed priesthood might have. and we friends have no need of, since we are all of the priesthood. We need neither a hireling priest nor a steeple house to put him in. Our founders were not the only ones demanding a shift in the balance of power as it existed in the middle of the 17th century. And of course, the loudest noise was made by those with the greatest authority to ensure their voices were heard, the politicians and the military men. But the religious groups were determined to make their voices heard with names like Ranters, Seekers, wonderful names, Fifth Monarchy men, following the Diggers and the Levellers. And many people believed that the world really had turned upside down in Britain in the 1640s and 1650s. What a wonderful idea. And it certainly looked as though it had turned upside down. With the execution of the king went the authority of the established church. That all-pervasive power which gave the state an agent in every parish. Was it the Stasi of its time, perhaps? Just as intrusive, just as controlling. Many hoped this was to be a permanent change. But the very names of the people who wanted to keep it permanent, the levellers and the diggers and so on, surely were enough to make the forces of inertia dig in and fight for a return of the almost status quo, with themselves in power again. And during one of his many spells in prison, George Fox gave us perhaps his most used, perhaps most familiar phrase. From Launceston Jail in 1656, he wrote, and I've extracted bits to the detriment of the poetry of his prose. So this is a man in prison. The world, he hopes, has turned upside down. And this is what he says. And I extract it. This is the word of the Lord God to you all, and a charge to you all in the presence of the living God. Be patterns, be examples in all countries, places, islands, nations, wherever you come, that your courage and life may preach among all sorts of people. And to them, then you will come to walk cheerfully over the world, answering that of God in every one. So he's in prison. The world is turning upside down. And he's telling us all to be cheerful. Well, contradictions abound, don't they? But whatever else you might see in his words, if you're a monarchist, you would see threat and rebellion in every phrase, encouraging citizens to think and act for themselves in all things eternal. Words, perhaps easily said, but much more difficult to act upon. So much surely depends upon who says them, who is listening, voluntarily or not. Even Fox must be held to account here. Valiant for truth, he said, walk cheerfully. How? Who whom? Who are you talking to? And how can they respond? Of course, these are principles we might all support in our heads. It's when we try to put them into action, we might find difficulties, which will encourage us to keep our mouths firmly shut. We might try to do our best, but we are each unique. We are likely to walk a different path for different reasons in different circumstances to seek cheerfulness as best we can. Did Fox assume we all seek the one absolute state of good cheer? I don't know. It's an assumption that's been made on everyone's behalf by our spiritual rulers ever since. They purport to know best. for everyone. Well, if the world did turn in the 1650s, it turned again in 1660. The state proved to be like one of the marvels of our present time, a self-righting lifeboat. You know those amazing things that if they turn over, they right themselves again. And not only did the state return, but as far as we were concerned, we dissenters, with more violence than ever before. And I can remind you, if I may, that we know what happened. We can see around history's corners and know what's coming next. We know how our founders, dissenters all, suffered. We know what happened, if you like, in France in 1789, where the world turned upside down for some again. In fact, a succession in France, 1830, 1848, 1871, Russia 1917, Germany 1919, and all failed attempts since. The established church, and until recent times, one was called communist, rides back to power on the back of the political military system. We know that, but our friends in 1660 had to learn the hard way. Slogans such as no cross, no crown, no bishop, no king, reinforced the power of what's called the restoration, the restoration. The church returned established and all-powerful. Ranters, seekers, and all their comrades were no more. Friends survived by dint of clever diplomacy, living for years on humble pie, and perhaps by changing their spots so as to become less of a threat to the authorities. But only just. Surely we can hope that we have not lost our unreliability-ness. Can we be relied upon to dutifully accept and agree with everything we might be told or ordered? Our society, along with all non-conforming Christians, whatever name they might have given themselves, has suffered a lifetime of slogans, words, and phrases, all attempting to diminish and ridicule us to keep us in our place. And here's one we're all familiar with. If God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. I think that was Voltaire in, 1768. And I see it as another slogan used by authority to justify the need for God, because their idea of God means order, obedience, payment of taxes, and all that goes with good government. It's an 18th century variation of the theme of no bishop, no king, result chaos. The age-old implication that we must have a God to maintain stability, order, and all the rest. And whose interest might that be? Who would want to bring into existence an all-powerful God? What are gods for? Why are they so useful? How are they so useful that they must be invented? And who does the inventing, I wonder? I think it all depends upon who's doing the talking and who's being obliged to do the listening. I'd like now to encourage you to think about opium for a minute. and a definition of opium, anything considered to have a stupefying or tranquilizing effect on people's minds. And an opiate, something which dulls sensation, physical or mental, inducing sleep, drowsiness, or inaction. And in the 19th century, in Western Europe, industrial Europe, it was in regular use under various names by all classes. Laudanum, if you like, a tincture of opium, to use the language of the time, was a godsend to working women with their 8-hour day, children and spouse. Mother carer's cordial kept babies asleep until eventually you didn't need to give them any more. Upper class women became addicts to ease the boredom of their non-working day. Gilded birds in gilded cages with nothing to do. So, and it was very much cheaper than a bottle of gin. So in various forms, opium was known about, and it was taken for all sorts of reasons. So opium, opiate. And you know what I'm going to say next, I imagine. Religion is the opium of the people. I suppose most people are familiar with that phrase. We might know, probably, that Karl Marx used it, but that's perhaps all we know. And perhaps like other phrases, we think we should know more about it, but we don't. We leave it till next time. Or we assume that its meaning is so obvious that we needn't think about it anymore. Interestingly enough, Marx was not the first person to use it, that phrase. Another German poet, Heine, wrote in 1840, "Religion that pours into the bitter chalice of suffering human species some sweet soporific drops of spiritual opium." And a few years after Marx, we bump into an Anglican clergyman called Charles Kingsley. His name was perhaps familiar to English folk. He wrote a novel called The Water Babies. He was an Anglican priest. You might also like to know that on a visit to Ireland, which was part of the United Kingdom, of course, in the 1840s, he referred to the starving Irish peasantry rather unfavorably compared with chimpanzees. And he wrote, "We have used the Bible as if it were a mere special constable's handbook, an opium dose for keeping beasts of burden patient while they were being overloaded, a mere book to keep the poor in order." So keeping all that in mind, I'd like to look more closely at those few words, which are only part of the whole. Religion, the opium of the people. And of course, we read it now in translation. And it depends who's doing the translation, I suppose. But this is what, if most people accept it's reasonable, this is what he wrote, Marx wrote. "Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress and the protest against real distress. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of a spiritless situation. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is required for their real happiness. The demand to give up the illusions about its condition is the demand to give up a condition which needs illusions. the criticism of religion is therefore in embryo the criticism of the veil of woe, the halo of which is religion. He put that in a book that nobody read, because nobody bought it, because nobody wanted to, called Contribution to Hegel's Philosophy of Right, and of course was not published with any success until after Marx's death. And we need to remember, I think I'm probably wrong, but I'll say it anyway, the vast majority of what Marx wrote was not published in English. I don't think Capital appeared until the 1890s in English. So the idea that Marx was spreading this amazing idea about opium and religion around Europe in the 1840s and 50s is erroneous. It's a remark, I think, which people sneer at without thinking about it, perhaps. And in fact, later on, Marx actually went on to say that religion might offer some comfort and hope to those masses of people struggling to stay alive in the industrial vortex in which they found themselves in Europe in the mid-19th century. And my words, for what they're worth, if the people need to be comforted with what are false and deceitful promises, then it is the society which uses such tricks to keep order which needs changing, and inevitably a religion would die out as obsolete. Well, do we conclude that Marx was as much a dreamer, a utopist looking for a utopia, as the man who remains the foundation upon which so many people have tried to build their lives since his early death at the hands of his Roman torturers? We live in the 21st century. We carry with us in our bones evidence that we live in a nuclear age, whether we like it or not. We belong to the Religious Society of Friends, or if we don't, we perhaps support its aims, our testimonies. I enjoy reminding myself of them, of the acronym PESTS. I think Quakers should be pests. We work for peace, equality, simplicity, truth, sustainability. Do we pests need to pledge belief in a God? Do we need to invent one? So there we are. I've mentioned two men, separated by 1800 years, with Voltaire somewhere in the middle, during which religious orders of every kind and none consolidated their power, yet these two men dreamed of utopia. One hoped the meek would inherit the earth. One hoped that that would result from the inevitability of economic self-destruction that capitalism carries within it, the seeds of its own destruction. Jesus of Nazareth, Jew. Karl Marx, Jew. In their hopes and fears, perhaps have more in common with each other than most people have been encouraged to see. And another thing they had in common, both have had their work mutilated beyond all recognition. Before I finish, could I go back to the beginning? I told you not to look for consistency. The first battle of the English Civil War was fought in that beautiful countryside of the south, southern English Midlands at Edge Hill, near Warwick, Stratford-on-Avon, October 1642. The war, I'd remind you, lasted from then until the execution of the king in January 30th, 1649. And I have a story for you which is far too good to be true, but one hopes that it is. The day before the battle, two of the king's men are reconnoitering the battlefield, which is at the foot of Edge Hill, which is not much of a hill, really. They were galloping about, spying out the positions and so forth for the battle tomorrow, and they came upon this elderly man who was ploughing the field. So they stopped him and said, "What are you doing? Do you not know that there's going to be a battle here tomorrow? We're going to fight. Well, it's no good ploughing the field." And the old man stopped his horse, leaned upon his plough handles, and looked up at the two young men sitting on their great big horses in their big floppy hats, lots of feathers and big shiny swords, big black boots, cavaliers, authority, command. And he said, "That's as may be for the likes of you, Your Honour, but we all must eat, so I must plough." So he carried on ploughing. I imagine he was killed in the battle, just as so many ploughmen before and since. Production of food is not so important as the fighting and winning of battles. So people who want to grow food to stay alive lose every time. And so often, the fighters call upon their God, by whatever name they give him, for help. I've visited many times the cemeteries on the Somme, the River Somme Valley, and at Ypres, the First War Battlefield cemeteries. The men whose remains couldn't be identified were buried under a headstone that said, "Known unto God." And may I finish with a few words from our Quaker faith and practice, which speaks, I hope, to us. 20.06. "Please be patient, those of you who have found a rock to stand on, with those of us who haven't, and with those of us who are not even looking for one. We live on the wave's edge, where sea, sand, and sky are all mixed up together. We are tossed head over heels in the surf, catching only occasional glimpses of any fixed horizon. Some of us stay there from choice, because it is exciting and it feels like the right place to be." Thank you, friend.